This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Adam Mayer. He's a San Francisco-based architect, and also Dane Fitzgerald, who's a blogger. They're both based in the Bay Area, and we're going to be discussing the ongoing tech exodus. And we touched on it the last time, the show I did with Adam, on urbanist trends for the 2020s. So it's great having you both back on the show. And if you both want to give our audience like a brief kind of a brief background information about yourself, like a brief short bio.
Okay, well, yes, as you said, I'm Dane. I've been living in the Bay Area for I grew up in California, but I lived in the Bay Area for about 12 years, and working kind of on the periphery of tech sector, the softer side of it, involving like copywriting and that kind of thing. No real coding chops or anything, and I've been sort of a casual observer of politics and writing about it for a while. Not so much horse race stuff, Dem versus Republican, but sort of political philosophy, ideology, and current.
Thanks, Robert, for having me back on your podcast. I'm Adam Mayer. I'm a Bay Area-based architect. I'm actually born and raised in the Bay Area, in the South Bay, the Silicon Valley area. And I've spent about the past decade in San Francisco practicing architecture, working for some large firms, working on mixed-use buildings, high-rises, and multifamily residential architecture. So I'm very interested in cities and urban planning and how those dynamics work.
Yeah, so with the exodus, remote work is huge. What do you see as some of the top emerging tech hubs? Some of them have been discussed for the past 10 years, and you get these areas like, I remember like in LA, Silicon Beach was being overhyped, and I'm not really sure if that's really going to take off, but I'd say like Austin's probably the big one, but also Salt Lake City, Dallas, Boston, the Research Triangle of North Carolina, Atlanta, even Miami is being hyped too. But the thing is, like, to what degree is it these new cities becoming emerging tech hubs, or just remote work spreading people out where they could live just anywhere?
Yeah, I've wondered that about, you know, the this work from home movement that would make it difficult for some other city to rise up as like this hot spot for urbanites, because now there's the idea of kind of a hot spot is becoming obsolete, isn't it, if everyone's just working from home? So I can see like a San Francisco or New York City fading, but nothing really taking its place other than some, you know, purely by in a comparative perspective, it starts to attract more attention because less is being focused on those legacy blue cities. But I question the idea of these other places becoming, you know, thriving, you know.
Yeah, I think it's hard to replicate the Bay Area and Silicon Valley just because this is kind of where it all started. It is spreading out now, and the pandemic has absolutely accelerated that. Two of the cities that are being talked most about right now in the news cycle and on Twitter and whatnot, obviously Austin and then Miami. And what's interesting about those two cities is there are incentives just from like a cost of living and tax point of view for tech companies and tech workers to relocate there. But they've already kind of established themselves as somewhat cultural hubs to compete with, you know, New York and San Francisco. You know, Austin has had South by Southwest, you know, for many years now, which has been a very big tech event. And Miami's hosted Art Basel, which is a big art fair, and there's always been a strong Latin influence with culture there and the connection to South America and the Caribbean. So I do think people are going to spread out just from the advantages of being able to work remotely. But I also still think that there are cultural amenities that this new creative class are attracted to. And another city people are talking about is Nashville. And of course, Nashville has a very, strong music culture there as well.
I want to add something real quickly on the music scene aspect. I don't think the music scene like we've known it, live music, is going to come back. So I wonder how much that matters. I was reading an article about Austin today in Texas Monthly, and they were promoting its music scene, a thriving music scene. But I think with live events taking a huge beating from coronavirus, and I think this will go on for a few more years, I don't think it will return in the same way. So live music, I don't know how much that's going to help a city's profile, going forward. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. I mean, live events and especially live music and musicians have taken a beating this past year. It's really tragic and sad to think about what's happened. But and who knows when it is going to come back. We don't know at this point when we're going to recover from this pandemic fully. But I do think there is going to be a pent-up demand for live in-person experiences again, especially with the younger generation who are kind of missing out on that right now. I'm in my late 30s now, but when I was in my, early to mid 20s, I wanted to be out every weekend. I wanted to be going to concerts. I wanted to be hanging out with my friends at bars. So I really feel for the younger generation. So I think there is going to be a pent up demand for this when we get through this. But you're right. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know if it's going to be kind of a hybrid between Zoom events and live events. Surely maybe there won't be the same demand for these big, like Coachella or Outside Lands type of big festival concerts.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see like an abrupt end to the pandemic. I think we'll see maybe like most people could be vaccinated by the fall, but there could still be like a couple year period where it's still a kind of a transition. And even if the pandemic is not there, it's still going to have like long lasting impacts.
I think there may just be fewer events, but they will be big and they will be outdoors. So something like
an
outside
lane. Yeah, that makes sense.
But the kind of, the sort of marginal niche music scenes, people into, noise music or synth music, like I these kind of one-off events and dive bars and things like that, I think you'll see much less of that.
To what degree do you think we'll see like a decentralization of the tech industry and other corporate industries as well?
No, we've already seen some, other companies leave San Francisco, like McKesson and, non-tech related.
I think Chevron left as well.
Yeah. So
Chevron.
And some more of the legacy technology companies, some of the old guard like HP, I think, was relocated their headquarters to Texas recently.
Oracle, HP.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it is because of tax policy. But to what degree is it just they're moving their headquarters so they can file it in, say, Texas, where there's a lower corporate tax rate? Are they relocating their entire workforce, or is it mostly just the headquarters where the taxes are filed?
That's a question. I think it depends on the company.
So I wonder if Texas will be something like an Ireland of the U.S. So we know companies are they file their taxes there, or they're registered there or something. Right, but they don't have necessarily a large workforce presence there. I don't know, but if there's any kind of overlap between Ireland's situation and Texas, it might be something worth considering.
Based on your observations and as well as like different articles and data, do you have an estimate like what percentage of the Bay Area's tech workforce is going to leave? I've heard some estimates it could be half.
I wouldn't be surprised if it approached 50%, just because with being forced into a remote work situation, and a lot of these large tech companies already had remote work policies that people could work from home for a certain amount of time, and the pandemic just accelerated that trend. And interestingly enough, my industry, architecture, it's kind of an old profession steeped in its ways. So I think a lot of large architecture firms were dragged kicking and screaming into this work remotely situation. But, you know, for a lot of firms, I think it's worked out all right. So it's not just the tech industry that might be impacted by the remote work situation as well. I'm curious to see what happens with other industries as well, where you don't necessarily need to be in person to do the job.
Yeah. I mean, if we're moving to work from home, you don't need to follow the company you work for to Texas. On the other hand, you know, the rents are lower there, and so that would be an inducement to leave.
So with these like legacy corporations, Google, Facebook, Twitter, like social media, obviously, do you think they'll keep their headquarters permanently in the Bay Area? And what do you see as like the future of corporate headquarters in the Bay Area? And is it more? It seems to be more like a lot of the maybe smaller kind of startups are leaving, or they'll keep their headquarters, but maybe like half of their workforce will leave.
Well, don't some companies have two headquarters, or there's like a second headquarters? So this gets a little
like one is like purely like they might have a headquarters, like the Twitter headquarters in downtown SF. That's like it's more like symbolic. But I forget which company it was. A major tech company spent millions to construct a new headquarters in South of Market district of SF, and then basically because of remote work, they basically had to sell it at a loss.
Oh, I think it was Dropbox, maybe.
Oh, that's right, Dropbox.
Yeah.
Yeah, the commercial real estate is really crashing in a way that residential is not. I mean, residential rents have gone down a little bit, but nothing like commercial, from what I understand.
Yeah, there is this. I'm not sure if it's impacting the like Silicon Valley proper, but it seems to be that downtown SF has been hit really bad, like the office market slump, and a lot of vacant office space. And the problem is, ideally, it should be transferred to residential, but the property tax laws make it difficult. They disincentivize that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, San Francisco has seen its residential rents and housing prices drop, but that's in contrast with the rest of the Bay Area. For instance, where I am right now on the peninsula or in the South Bay, in the more suburban areas, the housing prices have held strong or even gone up because there's been kind of this rush out of the cities. Now, in regard to, you know, if companies are going to keep a symbolic headquarters and, you know, move elsewhere, I'm not really an expert in state-by-state corporate tax code, but just speaking for the kind of rank-and-file employees of these large tech companies, I think a lot of them, even though a lot of them make pretty decent salaries, are just frustrated with the housing prices in the Bay Area and also in some areas the lack of quality schools. So there has been this incentive for people. I know just anecdotally talking to people, you know, Boise has been a place where a lot of people have moved to. Salt Lake City as well. I mean, obviously Austin, but also, yeah. You know, this was an interesting statistic. Do you know where the number one, the city where most people from San Francisco are moving out of the state of California?
It used to be Portland, but Portland's not doing so great now.
No, Portland's not doing well. It's actually Las Vegas.
That's interesting because one thing about Vegas is that, obviously the Strip's a really cool place, but it's always been kind of looked down upon as like more kind of working class or kind of pro, like more kind of upper middle class, like Swipple types have always kind of snubbed it, but that could very well change just because they have so many like really not like big homes that are affordable.
I mean, you could buy a single family house out there for 200,000-300,000. I mean, that looks very attractive to.
Oh yeah. So, yeah, I see someone. Vegas. Vegas is definitely up and coming now. I think we discussed this on our Urbanist show with Adam, but there is, like, it's traditionally been Vegas has been more kind of like a theme park, which is obviously great, but they're, like, the downtown area, you have, like, Fremont West, which is, like, a hipster area, which is more, I guess, becoming more like places, like, emulating places like Portland, as opposed to the stereotype of Vegas as just being casinos.
Yeah, which was started, that area was, you know, really funded and started by, you know, Tony Hsieh, who just passed away tragically. And
yeah,
he came from San Francisco. He started Zappos in San Francisco, and then moved it out to Vegas, and kind of wanted to create that urban creative class experience out there in downtown Vegas. And I read, you know, mixed reviews about how successful or unsuccessful it was, but, you know, it was an interesting vision.
Funny, I think of Vegas as a place for autonomous cars to basically, you know, practice their craft. It's just like wide open and sort of like the more manufacturer heavy, you know, real estate heavy side of tech find Vegas attractive. But I wouldn't think it'd be a place for, you know, Dropbox style businesses or, you know, software as a service, etc.
Do you think with the Barrier that they wasted their tech boom because of the zoning laws? If so, the zoning and like the NIMBYism is so against like that kind of change, like I think it's the mass tech exodus is a positive trend, but do you think that was a wasted opportunity with the zoning?
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you mean zoning for the benefit of people who work for tech companies? You know, driving prices down and attracting more people, that kind of thing.
Yeah, just in general, like especially like I'm thinking like in the core of the Silicon Valley. But as far as providing housing, but just as like providing, creating like urban amenities, but if a region is not willing to accommodate like their workforce, then it's probably better that people are leaving. But do you think the whole like NIMBY versus YIMBY issue will it be less of an issue with the exodus?
I think so. I mean, some pressure is definitely being taken off. But there are two factors that were driving up housing prices, and it's interesting because those two factors blame each other for the housing prices being high. One is of course, the high wages for the tech workers who came to the Bay Area over the last decade for the tech boom. Obviously, the wages drive up the real estate prices, but again, it's also the kind of landed gerontocracy who have owned their homes in the Bay Area since the 70s and 80s and have seen their home values appreciate by 1,000%. And also there's, you know, the Prop 13 property tax law, which means they get to keep their low property tax rate. And oftentimes these people see themselves as, you know, still part of the middle class because maybe they were when they bought their homes. But if you look at the value of their real estate holdings, they're definitely in the upper crest. So the YIMBY movement, which is kind of pushed back against the strict zoning laws, is made up of tech workers. So there are these two forces that have been adversarial over the past decade, and it's been kind of ugly, but they're both somewhat responsible for the situation we're in. And at this point, I'm not sure what the way out of it is. I mean, as I was saying, San Francisco has already seen its property prices drop, you know, by 30%, or like the rent prices. And I'm not happy to see the economy tank right now. I'm not happy to see that, but it is taking some of the pressure off of the overheated real estate market.
Are a lot of the small businesses and restaurants closing in SF because of the lockdown?
Yeah, it's horrible. It's absolutely tragic to see what's happened to the small business community in San Francisco. I really feel bad.
Yeah, I hear a lot of statistics about this nationwide. Something like a quarter of all small businesses are gone permanently. I wonder about the arena pattern, you know, like a business will leave and a new one is being formed. I can't imagine that it's favorable to new businesses. I mean, who would want to open some kind of brick and mortar, you know, business?
No.
Who would want to embark on that kind of thing now, right? But yeah, Oakland's pretty bad too on that front. There's a few like, you know, high profile beloved businesses. Like there's a place called Zachary's Pizza. Like,
oh yeah, the pizza spot. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to go away. A place like that, but you know, a little pop up shop situation is marginal businesses like that are gone. You know, food trucks and things like that. Although food trucks are in a little better position, I guess. And I know they've been very trendy the last 10 years or so, but yeah, a lot of businesses.
I think food trucks have actually done pretty well during the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah.
Relatively.
Yeah, take out, but that's still not enough to like sustain the economic viability of the businesses. And then with the people leaving, like the revenue was leaving the states. To what degree do you see like an overall like economic decline of California? I mean, the whole country is in a bad economic situation, but I say compared to the rest of the nation.
I guess it was already more difficult to be a small business owner in a place like California, so I would think it's suffering more than like in Oklahoma or something.
I think once we get through the pandemic, and even now, local governments and the California state government needs to implement policy to make it easier to start a small business and, you know, take away some of the red tape I'm San Francisco at the beginning of the pandemic did a good job of kind of small restaurants bypass some red tape to build out outdoor parklets for outdoor dining. But, you know, since the latest shutdown, there's not even been outdoor dining allowed. So, you know, they might have invested 30 to 50,000 in these outdoor seating areas. Now they can't even be used. They're, you know, being taken over by
There was an article about that recently in City Journal, and the framing would seem sort of accurate. It was claiming that these businesses were essentially hoodwinked into creating homeless hangout spots, you know, on their own dime. Because this on and off shutdown thing has made the parklets only once in a while useful, and in a kind of arbitrary fashion. So in the meantime, when they're not able to do outdoor dining, even, you know, homeless are moving in, and you know, and so there's sort of like a private sector auxiliary support for services that you'd think would be undertaken by the city. But anyway, on the food issue, there's been something called ghost kitchens that have sort of popped up during the pandemic, because with restaurants unable to accommodate dine-in, you don't even need to have like a storefront, a restaurant front. And so some of these companies or some of these restaurants are parceling out work to what they call ghost kitchens, which are kind of unregulated, and we're not really sure what the situation is there. So they can accommodate more delivery orders. And so that's, I guess, in a way, getting around some of the lockdown pressure.
You know, just overall, it's going to have long-term impacts of a much greater corporate consolidation with, like, Amazon. Amazon's seeing record profits, but restructuring the economy with less, like, much harder to, obviously bad for small businesses, but, like, the consolidation of the economy into, like, a handful of big tech companies.
Yeah, I see why people think that it's just a little too good to be true. You know, this pandemic comes along and makes these FANG companies even more valuable. But, it doesn't mean that, you know, so there's conspiratorial thinking around that. But I think it's an unfortunate sort of convergence of, external factors like, you know, this pandemic and it happening to help companies that were already poised to do well.
With remote work, there's sort of a issue of whether it's going to be fully remote work or it's going to be a hybrid. So if it's fully remote, then you will see like a more of an exodus out of California. But if it's a sort of a hybrid where workers can commute into the office, say, once a week, then we could see actually like more kind of like sprawl within California. But the thing is, like, with the Bay Area real estate, it seems that SF has been devastated, or at least like the rental price in SF is declining, but single family homes, those are still very strong, and the suburban regions are they've stayed strong and it hasn't really been impacted that much. So do you think it's going to be a hybrid or full remote work?
Probably depends on the company policy. I mean, I see if there's fully remote work and distributed teams throughout the country or even internationally, perhaps there will be situations where a company might have, you know, twice a year or quarterly meetups somewhere around the country for people just to meet face to face instead of, you know, doing all their calls on Zoom. But I think, I think it
kind of basic, just like sort of bare minimum engagement efforts, you know, the kind of things that the managers on the kind of softer side of HR oriented, I think they'll want to do something like that.
I mean, I will say, I do think this is the work from home is a good development for the environment in terms of cutting down on the amount of people commuting by a private automobile, which is, you know, I see that as a positive.
Yeah, traffic has been wonderful, freeway traffic primarily. I remember after the pandemic was new, all traffic was better, like local city street traffic as well as the freeways. Now local traffic is back to normal. It gets plenty crowded, but the freeways have gotten so much better during all this.
With the traffic, so you're estimating it's mostly because of the pandemic, or you think it will be a long-term trend?
Well, sort of like live music, I think it'll come back, but not quite as strong, you know. And I think it's better because, there's so few people now commuting long distances to work, you know, 20, 30, 40 miles. But they still have to run errands locally, so, you know, that remains the same.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm a pretty big public transit, but our public transit agencies in the Bay Area, BART, SFMTA, have just been decimated by the pandemic. Yeah. Because people aren't commuting, and they rely on, you know, fares for a lot of their revenue. So I don't know what's – I think they're all going to need some sort of government bailout at some point.
Yes, that's where having a Democratic administration at the federal level makes a difference. Those people are paying very close attention to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Those people, you know, people at the head of public transit. I mean, New York City is the kind of bellwether for how horrible this can get. But BART, yeah, what's that going to look like 5 years from now, you know?
They're expanding into San Jose. I mean, they're still building the extension, so –
Let's oh yeah, it probably won't be profitable. Do you think, like, long? We talked about this in our last show in urbanism, but do you think this is how much of a devastation is this for urbanism in general, for denser walkable communities, both pandemic itself and the remote work exodus?
I think both, and you know, in San Francisco, it's scary even just to walk around downtown right now because everything's closed and boarded up and you don't have the critical mass. So you mostly have just, you know, unhoused people and, you know, people strung out on drugs. And it's really gritty.
Are you talking about areas that were already a bit sketchy, like mid-market to the Tenderloin, or even like the financial district?
Yeah. Even the financial district too. It's pretty sad. It almost feels like we're going to that kind of a 1980s gritty urban condition. And I know New York is having some of the same problems. And it's interesting to see, you know, Andrew Yang just declared he's running for mayor of New York City. And he's already posted videos of himself going around to local businesses and trying to, you know, promote this upbeat message of, you know, recovery for New York. So it'll be interesting to see. But I do think the pandemic and work from home is, yeah, overall, I don't think it's been good for dense urbanism.
As far as New York City goes, blogger I read put it well. He said that the real industry there wasn't fashion or finance so much as it was people working in offices. And that industry has just been completely destroyed. But, it, you know, it's interesting. Yang running for mayor there kind of helps boost that, you know, flagship legacy city with all of this talk of, you know, the action moving to Miami or Austin, etc. Him running for mayor there helps symbolically and maybe ultimately materially keep it on the map, you know.
I mean, he does have a good chance just because of de Blasio has done such a lousy job. I was disappointed in Yang for coming out in favor of a cancel culture, but at least on the economic issues, he has a lot of, like, out-of-the-box economic solutions.
I don't want to derail the conversation, but when did he come out in favor of cancel culture? What was that?
With the whole thing with, like, Trump being deplatformed.
Oh, God. Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm less alarmed by Trump being deplatformed than I am, you know, everyone aligning against Parler in any kind of alternative, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, this isn't good for the country. This whole the last 2 weeks have been pretty insane, to say the least.
Yeah, it's added a kind of antitrust element to the conversation around deplatforming and cancel culture. I guess one good side effect of Trump being deplatformed, apart from, you know, Trump being deplatformed, but that's kind of a blue tribe thing speaking, I guess, is that it's made people aware of the kind of power that Twitter has. I mean, they just removed, you know, a democratically elected politician just like that. And so other countries have been put on blast as to the power that these American tech companies have.
And like German Chancellor Angela Merkel, like, denounced it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
AMLO,
yeah.
The president of Mexico, who's a socialist, basically, also denounced it. And it's interesting to see these other world leaders are speaking, you know, more in favor of free speech than Americans are right now.
Yeah, they have a legacy of being concerned about private actors having the kind of power to control speech. I mean, if you're an American, the downside is that, oh, well, that implies that they think governments should be controlling speech. Yes, that's true. But, you know, just at this juncture in history, I think that is the alarm that they're sounding is should be.
And yeah, even with like remote work, there are downsides because it does give corporations more power over their employees, and there are like some privacy issues.
Yeah, I've had to add some browser extensions, you know, that I wasn't quite sure what they were doing, but I realized later it's part of a kind of a monitoring apparatus. Well, I'm going to say, yeah, cybersecurity firms did great in 2020, you know, with all these companies scrambling to make sure that, you know, their intellectual property interests being preserved while people are working at home. So these cybersecurity companies are kind of working quietly in the background. I can't even think of the name of one right now. But yeah, so they did well last year. I figure they'll do well this year too.
Yeah, there's been this whole move to like the cloud infrastructure, and any company that's involved in building this digital infrastructure in the cloud has done really well and reaped some rewards over the past year. Yeah, I don't think as you were saying before, Dan, I don't think there's some, you know, grand conspiracy to enrich, you know, the FAANG companies or the cloud computing companies. It's just they were just beneficiaries of this situation that we found ourselves in the past year.
Are a lot of companies making pay conditional with the cost of living if for the workers who relocate? Because that does seem to be the case.
I think so. I think that's what's happening. I know Facebook, for one big example, said that, you know, at the start of this year, 2021, if people relocated out of the Bay Area, they would adjust their salaries accordingly, commensurate with the cost of living and wherever they ended up.
Do you think remote work could lead to a big increase in outsourcing to overseas?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah, I don't like thinking about that because I'm I'm not some kind of superstar as far as my skill set. So I'm like I said, I'm at the periphery of tech. I've been sort of on and off employed in it. And so, yeah, I'm a little concerned about that. Yeah, like a lot of people last year, I got the Robinhood app, and I'm scrambling to think of ways to have a financial cushion that don't rely on my being employed in tech.
I mean, back to your previous question about outsourcing to countries outside of the U.S., I think definitely other developing countries, you know, China, of course, and India, and then, you know, some smaller companies like, or smaller countries like, you know, Vietnam, for instance, you know, there's a big push for STEM education in these countries, and they're, you know, producing, you know, magnitudes more people that are adept at, you know, computer engineering and coding, you know, comparatively to what we have in the United States. So I think, you know, even though with the past decade, tech workers have been flying high with their high salaries and benefits, I don't necessarily think that that's going to come back. I think, you know, more companies will be able to take advantage of lower cost outsourcing overseas. So it's not just something that's going to impact manufacturing jobs in the next decade. It's going to impact tech jobs as well. And I think I don't think we're talking enough about this. I don't really hear many voices talking about this, but I think it's something we should be concerned about.
And automation, do you think automation could have an impact too? Which tech jobs are vulnerable from automation and which are pretty secure?
I'm not tech savvy enough to know the answer to that myself, but I imagine automation could play a role as well.
Yeah, one upside to the kind of work I do, just to get more anecdotal, is that it involves some understanding of quickly changing cultural and political norms in the U.S. So you have to kind of stay on top of that. And that's something that, you know, it helps to be a North American English speaker actually living stateside. So, yeah, something creative, creative enough or, yeah, such that it doesn't lend itself to being automated so easily. If anyone listening that, you know, wants to seeking a career in tech, go for something like that.
So that would be like data analytics, or at least taking, you know, for instance, a set of data, but then, you know, interpreting it through the eyes of a human.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so like if you're dreaming up, okay, I guess I'm getting away from tech per se, but if you're like dreaming up show ideas on Netflix, you're in a better position.
Right.
But, you know, of course, there's a lot of people who can dream up Netflix ideas, right? So, but that's bringing in kind of some other arguments. But yeah, if what you're doing is far too formulaic and doesn't involve any sort of creative input, you might be at special risk.
And also, like, the U.S. being the center, the global center of the tech industry is, it's also dependent upon the U.S. being a global superpower. But the thing is, like, it does seem like with U.S. and China, it seems like we are entering this kind of, like, soft Cold War, this kind of bifurcation globally between a U.S. sphere and a Sinosphere. So it's hard, yeah, it's hard to say if, like, China could surpass U.S. as the global tech superpower.
China's already developed their, you know, parallel universe of, you know, digital tools and digital infrastructure for the Chinese world. And they are also, you know, going to the developing world like the Middle East and Africa and Central Asia and, you know, pushing their technology in those areas. But with in terms of like full dominance over like global tech, I don't see, you know, China taking over American companies in the U.S. or North America or even, you know, in EU countries. But it's interesting to see what's happened recently with technology in China, especially with kind of the muting of Jack Ma, you know, the founder of Alibaba, and stopping his IPO, which was supposed to happen, I think, last November, of Alipay, which is basically, you know, kind of a Chinese version of PayPal.
Yeah. He's still missing, right? I mean, that's been...
Yeah,
that's,
they're saying he's just laying low somewhere.
Yeah, that stock has just been tanking. And so, that, I mean, I wonder what's going to come of that.
So China's preemptively, the Chinese government, the, you know, Communist Party in charge, Xi Jinping, has preemptively taken action to make sure that the tech oligarchy in China doesn't gain too much power. I mean, I know during the Trump administration, there's been a lot of rhetoric, you know.
Yeah, rhetoric. Trump had a lot of anti-tech rhetoric, but the joke about Trump is that he's always monitoring the situation. He actually didn't do that much, and it'll be interesting, like, with deplatforming, is it might force the Republican Party to be more skeptical of corporate interests, but I think globally, so if there is a risk of deplatforming offending another foreign power, and then that leading to a greater bifurcation, so you might have the United States and close allies using U.S. software and U.S. Social media platforms, but you could see like a Chinese sphere, a Sinosphere, or who knows, like maybe the European Union might go off and like form their own tech sphere. So yeah, I do see different countries form like creating their own versions. Facebook is already a thing now.
After the U.S. and China, who is best like positioned to have their own rival, you know, internet universe? I wanted to say Marvel Cinematic Universe somehow, but, you know, who can do that? Is Russia doing something like that?
Within Russia to a degree, but not so much having a sphere outside of their nation. I guess the European Union could possibly in the future, maybe India.
I think the U.S. should ally with the EU, and maybe the EU has taken, you know, more steps to, you know, try and at least... develop some good faith regulations on the internet, like GDPR and whatnot. And I think if the U.S. can work more closely with the EU in you know, having a more balanced internet and social media experience, I think that would be a positive thing for the world.
We're at the end of the show. Adam or Dane, is there anything you'd like to add about the tech exodus or the future, or thoughts on the future of the tech industry?
I would say that I don't think in India having its own internet to rival anything like what China or the Russia or the U.S. is doing is very feasible. They're too ingratiated, if that's the right word, with the U.S.
The thing about India is they're big for outsourcing, but I don't think they're producing the amount of innovation as China is.
Yeah, they don't really seem like there's any desire to either. So.
Yeah, they are very linked to U.S. companies.
Yeah, I just wanted to say one comment about, you know, the tech exodus, you know, from the Bay Area and California in general. I do think, you know, this has been an accelerated trend. We've seen the numbers. People are leaving California. I think we're actually losing a congressional seat for the first time in history due to depopulation. But I still think, you know, California, at the end of the day, it's, you know, it has great weather. It has great natural amenities and cultural amenities. I don't think it's going to go away. Its role, its power might be diminished slightly, but it could be just temporarily. So
yeah, and if we had a smart leadership in the state, like they would think of ways of creating like communities that could appeal to these remote workers, these kind of hubs.
Yeah, yeah, I think the sad thing is that with people so enamored of digital products and being glued to their phones and their laptops and tablets, it doesn't matter that much that a place tries to provide all kinds of great local amenities. All the amenities are in the cloud. I mean, that's probably going too hard in the digital future direction, but that's just kind of how it looks to me.
And even before the pandemic, like I have actually noticed a trend. Like the obvious would be the end of the malls, the death of malls, but just an overall trend of like a decline in pedestrian foot traffic, even with like the hype of like urbanism. I think a lot of it is just people are spending more time indoors online.
Yeah. Anyway, I think the same kind of inertia in sclerotic nature of the U.S. that people complain about a lot is why these legacy states and legacy cities aren't going to fade. You know, so much of the 20th century is just locked in at this point.
Adam Mayer and Dane Fitzgerald, it's been a great talk. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for Robert.
Take care, Robert. Take care, Adam.
All right, guys. That was a good conversation. Thanks.